Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats.
And it's the most wonderful time of the year. It's the most I dare sing without getting sued for copyright. But guess what? If you're within the sound of my voice, that must mean you're in the seats with once more. As always, my name is Dave Voigt, and I am the host of this podcast, where we sit down with a wide-ranging variety of entertainment industry professionals, and we pick their brain about current projects, state of the industry, how they got started, and so very much more, in light and in a conversational fashion. You know, if you like how we do things around here, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that you do, because let's face it, you're listening right now. And if you are, keep listening and subscribing. Hit subscribe. Give us a little 5-star rating on your podcast provider of choice. We're available pretty much everywhere. Places like Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. And plus, we archive every single one of our episodes over at our In The Seats YouTube channel. So if you can give us a like and subscribe there as well, God knows we would appreciate it. Also, don't hesitate to check us out on the social media. We're on the Facebook, X, formerly known as Twitter, or as I call it, Twix. We're on Instagram, Letterboxd, Threads, Tumblr, probably a few other places. I lose track. At In The Seats for all sorts of fun updates, and finally, and I do dare say most importantly, please pay us a visit over at In The Seats, inseats.ca, for all the latest and greatest from the world of film, television, basically the moving image at large, because guess what? If we love to watch it and write about it and talk about it, we'd love it even more when you come by and read about it and listen about it. So please do us that kindness and pay us a visit. On this very special episode, we are celebrating the one and the only Canadian Film Day, or Canada Film Day, however you want to put it. It is a fantastic nationwide event put on by our friends over at Real Canada and supported by theaters, individuals, and outlets such as ourselves in a variety of different capacities as we celebrate all things Canadian film. There will be free screenings all across the country in various locations, again, just all sorts of fun stuff, just celebrating what it means to love our Canadian film, because that's why I'm here. You know, I don't know about you, but that's why I'm here. And again, it's one of those things that, to me, it's important because it really highlights how important it is to support our own stories and our own art form. And if you want more info on screenings or sort of fun stuff that's happening, go to canfilmday.ca for more info. But before I bore you with that, I'm not going to bore you with that, but we had the unique pleasure of doing something. We had the unique pleasure of sitting down and talking with one of Canada's finest actors, who just happens to be on the board of directors for Real Canada, and is very involved with paying it forward and supporting our stories and our voices. And I dare say he is the Canadian actor, quote unquote. We had the unique pleasure of sitting down with the one and only Colm Feore, just to talk about Canada Film Day, Real Canada, his career, his work, and how it all kind of ties into just the joy of doing the work and the joy of paying it forward, and the importance of storytelling in all of its wild and crazy forms. But like I said, go to canfilmday.ca for details on all the events and free screenings that are going on tomorrow, which is officially Canada Film Day. But first, enjoy our talk with Colm Feore, because, and I say this often, but this time I'm actually telling the truth. This time, I really, really mean it. It's a good one. All right, well, Colm, obviously, first off, I mean, just, you know, happy Canada Film Day. And I mean, just thank you for the time today. I really appreciate this.
It's your pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest.
Now, I mean, this is a loaded question, but I mean, I got to lead with this because I'm curious. Because for the past 15 or 20 years or so, I mean, you've obviously had this great career at Stratford and you've worked with so many different people, but you have been labeled, for better or for worse, sort of as the Canadian guy in so many different projects. I'm kind of curious, when did that sort of label really start to stick? Was it Trudeau or was it starting to come on before that?
I think it was... I mean, listen, I can't really speak to this other than I can say there was a tension with 32 short films about Glenn Gould.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So I parlayed 32 short films about Glenn Gould. What happened is I got the part And we made the movie. And François Giraud, and I was here in Stratford. We did a lot of rehearsing here in Stratford. François came down and made me dress up as Gould and walk around the lake. It was just maddening. And then we'd lie under pianos at the Royal Conservatory, and he'd play music. And I just go, I'm just going to pretend, dude. I don't need all this. But anyhow, I guess it sort of helped. In any event, we make the movie, and he says, you know, you could do more of this. And at the time, I was working in Stratford, so we had to work around the schedule. And I'd always worked in Stratford. And he said, well, yeah, the only thing is you have to be available. And of course, available is basically a nice way of saying out of work. And I said, well, how long do I have to be available to kickstart a film career? He said, 2 years. I said, François, that can't happen. I mean, I have obligations. I got ex-wives. I got children. No. But then when Gould came out, and when it got to DVD, a VHS and Laserdisc, I don't think we even had DVDs then. Back in 92, 93, I thought, okay, I'm going to take a risk. And I got a bunch of copies together and I went to New York and I went to LA and I went, I'm going to try this. And I slipped them under doors and I got into rooms I had no business being in. You know, suddenly I'm doing auditions and meetings with Robert Redford, Sidney Lumet. I'm meeting Milos Forman. It's surreal. And some of them had claimed to have seen the film. Redford was so sweet. He said, I want to talk to you about why I programmed it 3 times at Sundance and blah, blah. And so suddenly there was that. Shortly thereafter, there was Trudeau. And that did reasonably well. But also people on the street, because it was on CBC and it was essentially free, right? People saw it a lot. And they went, you're that Trudeau guy. Then the trifecta of this idiocy was Bon Cop.
Of bad course,
right. And so now, you know, I can be in the biggest blockbuster American hit, 9.5 feet tall and blue with red eyes and bad teeth. Nobody cares. They're still speaking to me in French. You're not seen Thor? Come on. Stephen King? No. Okay. Never mind. And, you know, it has really been, it's been a gift and a blessing. And I'm not going to look this gift horse in its mouth, other than to say, if that's my legacy, I'm fine with that. You know, it and Captain Canada, in whatever way that I can be that. I mean, we got Paul Gross for that. But all sorts of other people who are perfectly good at that and have done things that are much more iconically Canadian. On the other hand, you know, Dave, it's a living. You just keep showing up.
Well, and I mean, it's weird because, I mean, I love that you even brought up Stephen King because, I mean, I think my two first exposures to you sort of initially were probably Red Violin. And then Storm of the Century, which came pretty close together. And I mean, there are two polar opposites of projects.
Well, and I have little bits of Red Violin here and there. Over in the corner is the cane.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Silver-headed cane from Storm of the Century, along with a handful of swords. Because, of course, if you're a classical actor, you got to have swords somewhere in your house. Well, but you know what? All of those things cross-pollinate and helped each other out. You know, either they paid a bit better than the Canadian films, and so one could afford to do them, and then encouraged. Right now, at this stage of my career, I am very excited working with young filmmakers, particularly female, and say, you know, listen, if you've got something you want to do and you need an old bald white guy, I'm there, and that has paid off. I mean, I did Kelly McCormick's film Sugar Daddy, and it's a terrific movie.
Oh, Kelly's fantastic.
She's just the coolest woman I know. And well, apart from my wife, who's remarkable. But, you know, she had a female cinematographer, female director, female designers. And so there was a place for me in that. Megan Follows, whom I admire as an actor, and I had done Romeo and Juliet with her here in Stratford. We were doing an event here at the festival. And she said, you know, I'm directing TV. I'm directing film. I want to do this. I said, if you ever need somebody like me, please just call. So she did. And I went off to Hamilton and shot her movie, Maternal, which is now called something like She Came Back or Comes Back, little thriller horror thing. And then I'm out in Bayfield shooting a movie for Brad Turner, who had directed me in the series 24. And he's doing our first post-COVID or actually mid-COVID movie, but I needed the work. We'd been unemployed at Stratford for 8 months. And suddenly he came up and said, listen, we've figured out a way to do this in the pandemic. Do you want to come shoot this movie? I meet a young, wonderful woman as an actor in this show. And I said, well, we've never met. And I said, well, we should have met. I'm sorry, what? Well, we should have met because I was cast as someone in that film you did for Megan. But because your schedule didn't allow it and because you were more important, I was replaced. And I just said, oh, shit. Now, I am so sorry. Listen, if there's ever you're doing anything that I can help, or it's funny you should mention it. I'm doing my first short film and I have two parts for you in it. Can you meet me in Hamilton for $165? I went, yes, of course I'll be there. And so, you know, whatever the establishment, my foundation of my career has given me, it's really benefited me greatly in the opportunity to be able to do this kind of work with these kind of folks. And that has been thrilling.
How did sort of the experience on stage, I guess, keep you grounded and keep you together for, like you say, taking a meeting with Sidney Lumet, which is a different beast.
Yeah, well, the other thing about Sidney, he loves the theater and he loves actors. Loved, alas. I did a couple of pictures for him, but the likes of him and John Yoo and all of these Clint Eastwood, Michael Mann, I've been really lucky. Bruce Beresford, Kenny Branagh, I've been really lucky. I've worked with all manner of folks. And my foundation in the theater was what has given me the confidence to do it, and particularly to here at Stratford, because I grew up, I was basically birthed on the festival's thrust stage, right? So you're essentially 210 degrees. There's like a camera everywhere, there's someone everywhere. And so when you learn to be okay with that, then somebody putting a camera wherever suddenly isn't a problem. I'm currently in Texas working with Billy Bob Thornton, and Billy is remarkable. He's a terrific actor, but you know, we were discussing our various backgrounds, and he said, I came from a much more improvisational background. Even though I was in a theater troupe in LA, you know, we were making shit up as we went along. And so I have that really adapts very well to film. Well, I grew up doing Shakespeare and Moliere and Chekhov. Strangely enough, that too adapts rather very well to cinema. Because what happens on the thrust stage is I alone tell you, this is the wide shot. This is the medium shot. This is a close-up. And now it's time for to be or not to be. That's all I want you to see. It's all I want you to hear. And so I have editorial control that I completely yield the moment I step on a film or a television set. And yet, having that experience gives me, I mean, I'm still always nervous. It's still always, you know, hair-raising to do it, but at least I have some solid foundation and background that I can count on and go to for resources.
Well, I mean, even something like when you step on the set of Riddick and playing the Lord Marshal, and I mean, I can imagine you got the direction of heading to hit the, I need you to hit the back of the room with this character. It's like, trust me, I know what to do,
Yeah. And you know that movie was crazy because we were doing it, and my costume was handmade by armorers. The gloves alone were 10 grand. Metal, just hammered. Everybody else was in like foam rubber, which meant that they kept falling over because they get all steamed up. It's like they were wearing wetsuits, and these huge guys would just like collapse. And I was fine because I had a breathability with the metal. But at one point, they forgot that I was supposed to fight Vin. And they went, holy shit, we're shooting that this afternoon. And you've got to fight Vin with sticks and this and swords and jump around. I said, have you ever seen Hamlet? He talks for 3.5 hours and then there's a fight. Show me to the fight room. Let's work on the choreography. We'll be fine. And we were. And I thought, you know, this is what is so helpful about a grounded classical career where you have to sing a bit, dance a bit, fight a bit, you know, whatever it takes, you need to do. And that kind of adaptability makes us useful in cinema and TV. You know, it's why we get asked back. At least I think so. And also, I've said before that, you know, if you've got a classical career, when you look at something like Riddick, sometimes we are, or Thor and, you know, Spider-Man and all these things that I've been very, very lucky enough to do, we often have to say things that are heroic and dumb. And you want something done, dumb, said heroically, you need a classically trained actor. And if you look around Riddick, me, Judi Dench, Linus Roach, I think Tandy Newton had done, Tandaway now, Newton had done some, Carl had probably done some. You know, we knew our way around classical text. I remember once somebody tried to mess with me. Kelly Nestruck is a writer here for the Globe. And when I was doing King Lear, in, you know, and to just finish some of these blockbustery things, he decided to throw at me a questionnaire. 10 quotes, 12 quotes, superhero movie or Shakespeare? I got them all right. Yeah, he had to concede. I think I got a Globe and Mail coffee mug or something. But it was a really wonderful exercise in how similar these things can be. And you know, the guys who were writing this stuff going, it needs to sound like once more under the reach, dear friends, once more, only not that good. Okay? Because it's not going to sound good coming out of this guy's mouth. So, you know, listen, it's a living.
No, for sure. No, absolutely. And I mean, that dovetails into something I'm dying to ask you about Bone Cop, Bad Cop, because I mean, obviously, I can imagine on the surface when you initially read it, it'd be like, okay, this is a cute sort of riff on the whole Lethal Weapon thing. It'll be fun and it'll go on. But I mean, what was it about it that kind of drew you in? Because I mean, after seeing it and having seen the success of it, it really felt like a bit of a linchpin moment in Canadian cinema where the perception of it was beyond sort of the art house or the, you know,
Yeah.
artistic kind of thing. Like it was more commercial, it was more accessible.
Yeah. Well, part of it is because Patrick Huard, who wrote and starred in it, was brave enough to sort of tell the truth about the bilingual experience. And, you know, I think it's probably a bit of a 60-40 split into who he's taking the piss out of more. I think the Anglophones get kicked in the nuts a bit more often. But, you know, as he said to me when we were promoting it first round, he said, I didn't worry about being accepted in English Canada. I was worried I wouldn't be able to ever go back to Chicoutimi because they'd go, dude, you betrayed us, right? But he said, listen, I just had to tell the truth. And to be frank with you, what happened was Kevin Tierney, God rest him, was producing and writing it with Patrick. They asked me to do a meeting. And we did a meeting in Montreal at, I think, a Greek restaurant up on Park Avenue. And I'd flown in for this and I'd read it. I'd read the draft that they had, and I thought, this is a real good part. This could be a really good part for me. I can pretend to speak French. I've got a daughter who's going to ballet school. I've got this stuck-up boys' school education, you know, with an immigrant kind of sensibility, and I'm trying to, you know, balance succeeding in Canada. There's a lot about this that dovetails very nicely for me. And so what I tried to do during the course of the lunch and the meeting was say, this is me. This could be me. And here's where I connect exactly. Here's my story. And I pitched myself at these two guys pretty hard. And I said, you know, it could be more like that. It could be more like this. You could, and I could see Patrick was, the wheels were turning, but I knew I was pitching for my career. I knew this could go many different ways. And I had a certain amount of complications because they didn't have their shit together, they didn't have their money together immediately. And I got an offer to go to do Julius Caesar on Broadway with Denzel Washington.
Oh, damn.
Needless to say, one was going to do that because the show was basically sold out before we even opened because Denzel was doing it.
Yeah.
And I said, guys, don't get your money until we're finished with Denzel in New York. You know, if you could put it off, I'll be free the moment that play is done. And then I'll come home and we can start. And they wanted to go with me, and push comes to shove, they not only managed to just find their money just in that time frame, but Patrick changed the script. He started changing stuff because you've taken the Mickey out of me. And you know, I said, look, the guy's French is going to be not Quebecois French. He learned it at school. He learned it maybe at university, and he's got stacks of, as I had, Jacques Brel and Edith Piaf records. And you know, you can make fun of yourself. And it's funny, the more I get it wrong and the more ridiculously sort of uptight schoolboy French I have, the funnier it is for Quebecers. But it also then hits at the very heart of every Canadian who's been forced to go to a French school every time, you know. And let's face it, I played Trudeau. Trudeau was the guy who gave us a bilingual country. There's joke upon joke upon joke in this. Not to mention that I read his son's book, Terrain d'Entente, in both official languages and put Easter eggs playing it like his father at various points. So, me doing Bon Cop and speaking French and trying to be the best Canadian sacrificial lamb as I am for Anglophones who wish to speak French and show respect to our Francophone Canadian brothers and sisters. I mean, it's ridiculous. Everything about it is ridiculous, but it spoke to the experience of anyone who's ever worked for Air Canada and has to do that stupid announcement in both languages. Anybody who's trying to understand the government and the backside of your tax form, what the? Come on, people, right? Or just trying to order a croissant and a coffee and you get a crouton and a glass of wine instead and go, yeah, I'm fine with that. You know, it's spoken to our lived experience, right? And all across the country, we were welcome, even in Vancouver, which, you know, you cross the Rockies, French is not it. But what was really fun was we got to meet all kinds of new Canadians who found that it spoke to their experience. And that's part of what Real Canada is all about. You know, we're getting Canadian stories to Canadians, new Canadians, Indigenous Canadians, Francophone, Anglophone, it doesn't matter what. We can tell each other our stories and understand each other better. And so we come together with love and understanding, to be cliched about it, and not with hate. And so that's why I'm a board member of Real Canada. It's why I champion the whole idea and why hopefully, you know, I can use my career as a kickstone to get things going in conversation about, well, why do we do this? How do we do it? How can I do it? Because that's part of our mandate too. We have National Canadian Film Day, is that one day a year where we can focus on these stories and get people's interest up by getting national and indeed international attention, because we're showing Canadian films around the world. But also then, you know, our movies in schools, our New Canadians program, our Aboriginal programs, our programs for getting kids into the industry. So where we explain to them how the jobs work, what the jobs actually are. You want to be a cinematographer, writer, director, actor, grip, wardrobe, costume, makeup, hair, whatever. And we have all these programs that answer these questions for Canadians, which I think is really cool.
No, I mean, I love that you bring that up because I mean, even on a personal level for me, because I mean, I'm an ex-Montrealer. I've lived in Toronto for 30 years, and I mean, Bon Cop, Bad Cop. I mean, I couldn't explain it to people until they saw that movie, and it's like, you know, people looked at me like I had two heads when I was coming in trying to speak French.
Well, my favorite thing is going to Americans and they say, Bon Cop, I hear it's a really successful Canadian movie. What's it about? And I describe the opening scene where at the frontière and you're now leaving Ontario, welcome to Quebec, and there's a body on the top, and the two cops get up there and they're kind of treating each other like assholes. And then it all goes to hell and they grab a piece of the body and they rip it in half. Every Canadian laughs. Every Canadian just goes, oh shit, yeah, that's funny.
Because everybody knows.
But every American goes, oh man, geez, that's weird. I went, yeah, I know it is, and it's really funny. And then we made another one. And in fact, as soon as I finish what I'm doing in Texas, we're going to start doing a 6-episode Bon Cop television series,
Oh, there they are.
which will answer some of the pressing issues. Because what Pat said to me after number two, he said, you know what, we're missing something here. There is an original voice. We can't be shy about this. We got a Francophone. We got an Anglophone. We need an Indigenous voice. So imagine an Anglophone, a Francophone, and an Indigenous cop walk into a bar.
I love it. I love it. I
It
can't
all goes
wait.
to hell. It all goes to hell. And we're planning on touring around Canada, like shooting on a reservation somewhere, maybe near Gaspésie, then Montreal, Calgary, Ottawa, and basically touring the country, showing what it looks like, how beautiful it is, and you know, all the ridiculousness that Patrick can come up with because he's real good at that.
Now, I mean, how do you think sort of the definition of Canadian cinema has changed? Because, I mean, it feels like to me, Bon Cop, Bad Cop was a bit of a moment to sort of expand the palette a little bit because, especially in earlier years, people would have this imagery of what Canadian cinema was supposed to be or Canadian television. Now it's a lot broader. I mean, how do you think sort of we as an industry have done it sort of to push that out, but also with Real Canada, just to sort of, I guess, cement the perspective that in many ways we are at a par, not necessarily with quote unquote Hollywood, but I mean, we are no different than anyone else. We're just telling our stories.
We're telling our stories, and where our particular genius is that we've managed to figure out how to do it for very little money, and that is a remarkable thing. You know, my managers and agents said, "Well, Bon Cops is so successful. When's it coming to the States?" I said, "Probably never." I said, "Well, why not?" I said, "Because it doesn't need to. It's a success. It made more money than it cost to make, so we paid back the government, we paid back the taxpayer, and they made some money. So we might make another one." That's it. That's it. We're telling our stories to ourselves and we're enjoying that. And because it didn't cost an arm and a leg, we now can turn around and figure out. And I did say to somebody, you know, we do this on the back of our experience with American blockbuster films and huge television series, because all of our crew and our actors and our support staff in Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, and beyond are all trained in the blood, sweat, and very many tears of American cinema and TV, because it's all made. Right? So we know how to make stuff for $120 million. But that gives us an enormous amount of expertise when you want to make it for a million.
120,000.
Yeah, or 120,000, or God forbid, 10,000. And of course, we all are willing, as we let Netflix subsidize our new Canadian filmmakers, you know, come along. I'll do any Canadian film for a young filmmaker, particularly for a woman. I am really keen on supporting anybody who's got something to say. How much will it cost? Nothing. Actress says it's got to cost $165. Well, I'll take your $165 and I'm there, right? I'm not going to make a living doing that, but it's not about me making a living. It's about you telling your story and me being there if I can help to get the word out. So Real Canada shines a light on Canadian film and tries to keep, you know, indefatigably the word out there that we are making great stories with great ideas and great people, remarkable people who are very, very skilled. But you need to know that their work is out there. You need to know where to see it. And the fact that we can show it to you for free for 24 hours on National Canadian Film Day, on any platform, in any old folks' home, library, military establishment, consulate, you name it, and on all these streaming platforms and our national and other broadcasters nationally, you know, for free, that is going to hopefully draw more attention and suddenly get people thinking like you. Hey, wait a minute. We're pretty good. On top of which, if you were looking to pat yourselves on the back, Dune made some money, and I find it amusing that nobody can pronounce Denis Villeneuve and thinks he's Spanish. I love that. You know, I like correcting them. I say, hey, and who are the funniest people in Hollywood? Most of them are Canadians. And let's face it, anybody named Ryan. Okay, so just to start with, so let's not for a second think that we don't have the skill set, the imagination, the writer skills, the director skills. God rest him, Norman Jewison, Charles Officer, Don Shabib. We're memorializing all those folks on National Canadian Film Day. We lost them sadly last year, but they have huge resumes. There are 25th, 30th, 25th anniversaries of magnificent, very internationally recognized, groundbreaking Canadian films happening this year, our 10th plus year of National Canadian Film Day. We got a lot to be very proud of. And so, you know, for me, it's a 24/7, 365 day a year job as being part of Real Canada. But NCFD, National Canadian Film Day.ca or whatever we are, yeah, is it natfilmday.com or .ca? We get a chance to talk to you guys about it and then say, hey, if you tell two friends, then maybe they tell two friends. And they start to discuss it in the same way you have, saying, there's something here that speaks to us that didn't need to cost $100 million. That's kind of irrelevant. Sure, I can watch stuff blow up and it'll be fine, but I know that CGI. I know that was done in, you know, Taiwan or Korea or wherever they get 55 animators to make that stuff happen. I want a story about me and about the people I live next to. We were just in a bunch of us from Real Canada, Adam McGoin, Veronica Tennant, also on the board with me, and Sharon Corder and Jack Bloom, our executive and artistic director. We were just for a sleepover at Rideau Hall with Her Excellency and His Excellency. And we showed them two screenings, sold out screenings, one in French, one in English, of Immigrant Stories, Kim Tui's Governor General's award-winning story, Rue.
Oh, and fantastic,
then,
yeah.
It's amazing. And then Peace by Chocolate, about this brilliant Syrian family who come, you know, the guy wants to be a doctor and his dad said, we need a job. And I make chocolate in Syria. Why don't we make chocolate here? And they've made chocolate to the extent that at some UN summit, Trudeau is advertising Peace by Chocolate and suddenly sales went through the roof. And now they're so successful, he's not going to be a doctor. They're chocolatiers. But these stories were received by new Canadians, both Francophone and Anglophone, and that was largely their third languages each, from around the world. And every one of them, to a person, stood up and said in the Q&A, this is my story. And it's patently not. You know, Kim Tui's thing is about Vietnamese boat people coming to Montreal.
Yeah.
You're from Cameroon and you're from South America and you say it's your story. Well, it's about the struggle. It's about getting here. It's about surviving. It's about the sacrifice. It's about family. And you go, yeah. These are our stories. And so watching these people take ownership of this stuff was just thrilling. And it really did create in the minds, I think, of the Governor General and all of those government minister people and their assistants, associates, and deputies that we could convince to come to Rideau Hall for the night, free food, free wine, and see a Canadian film. They went, oh, this works. This is doing a job for Canadian citizenship. This is telling our stories. This is, and as Kim said in the Q&A, she was just brilliant. She said, look, What I love about doing this, and she said, I will go to the opening or the premiere or the running of this film anywhere anyone wants to talk to me, because this work brings us together without hate. And there was an audible kind of, ah, yes, from the assembled crowds. And I thought, you know, if you were looking for something that made us distinctly Canadian, we're still hanging on to that as a characteristic, as a national characteristic. Yes, there are people nibbling at our heels and trying to erode that and trying to denigrate that, but I still believe we cling to that and that it's valuable and that it's certainly worthwhile when we're trying to welcome people. And you know, our programs are in the schools, getting film in schools, like their mini film festivals that the kids pick, and then we send them directors, actors, producers to chat with them about how these things got made, and that they, you know, how they could get into the business and make them themselves. But then we have our New Canadians program, our Aboriginal program, our showing kids how to get into the industry programs, and then National Canadian Film Day on top of everything to draw attention nationally to the work that we're doing. And I've got to believe that it has value for all of us as Canadians and as citizens and sharing our responsibility as citizens. And so if I get tarred with, you know, a little Canadian thing, I'm fine with that. You know, you look at Marty Short or Lorne Michaels in anywhere they are in America doing whatever, you know what they're always wearing? The Order of Canada.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're
And
right.
you know
You're
what?
absolutely right.
I am so proud of them as a member of the order myself, an officer. I am delighted to see them doing it because it really just comes back. It's a thread, a spider web of connection that says, I know where I'm from. And you know, darn it, they like me.
And I mean, our stories are so multifaceted too. And I mean, that is the strength. I mean, to put a bow on this, really. And I've got to ask, because you seem like a very pay it forward kind of guy, and not everyone in this industry has that mentality. I mean, someone who's booking a run with Denzel on Broadway isn't necessarily thinking about getting other people into the business. So when he's done, there's still a business to sustain. Have you always been had that pay it forward mentality, like even from early on in the business?
Yeah. I'll tell you why. I mean, I started here in Stratford. I mean, I went to theater school in Montreal. I was trained by very good people who were from Stratford, some of them. Douglas Rain, one of the greats, and the voice of Hal in 2001, used to live right across the street from me here, played my father in Hamlet. But these are the kinds of people I grew up admiring and then to work with, and then came here. It's a repertory company. You're doing plays that have existed for 450 years, even longer, and you're doing them with people who've been doing them for their entire lives. There's always going to be somebody in the room who's played your part, to whom you can go and say, I'm lost. I really don't know what to do. And I'm going to face an audience of, at the time I came here, the big theater was 2,272 seats. And sometimes it was full. And you're out there alone and you're talking with Shakespeare's language and you're naked and afraid and alone. The only way you can survive this is by trusting that the people beside you and behind you in rehearsal and in playing have told you the truth about their experience. Because they stole it from somebody, and they stole it from somebody, and they stole it from somebody. My entire career, I started here with Len Carey. God love him. He's so kind and so generous with me. And he was playing Petruchio, and I was playing Tranio, which is the second male lead, the servant in Taming of the Shrew. And then we did Coriolanus together the same year. And then we did another couple of plays. And he and Brian Bedford and Martha Henry, all these people just shared. And sometimes it wasn't nice how they shared. You know, Brian would come across the stage in front of a live audience and readjust my wig falling off, or say things subtle and helpful like, are you going to play it like that? And you think, that's not a good idea. I shouldn't do that. What should I do? And, you know, over the course of my many, many years here, people just helped. They passed the baton. Sometimes they passed you flaming bags of shit, but they passed it. And they said, listen, this is how this goes. Sorry,
This is
dude,
the
you're on
lesson
your own.
to learn from it.
Yeah. And so go and fail. And you know, people would shout at me, John Hirsch. And the opening night, John Hirsch, God rest him, was the artistic director when I first came in 1980, 1981. And we did the opening night. of The Taming of the Shrew. Len was a big hit. Shari Flett as Kate was a big hit. And I as Tranio was a disaster. And he came back to tell me so. What? He was 6.5 foot tall, Hungarian, homosexual, Jewish, everything, you know, and it's all like this. What are you doing? What the hell are you doing? This part is supposed to be funny. You are supposed to be funny. It's not funny. I said, well, John, nobody told me it was funny. I thought I was playing the servant I disguise as the master, and I just play it straight through. No, you don't do that. That's not what you're doing. He wasn't directing the show. He was just the artistic director. He had just dropped by to shit on me from a great height. He said, I should have hired Heath Lamberts. He's funny. God rest Heath Lamberts. But, you know, suddenly you go, okay, so not sucking would be the plan. How do I not suck? And so I then set about finding people going, help me out here. What do I do? How do I get better at this? And then finally, the stage manager would have to stop me. Please get a message to Column. No, the yellow monkey wrench is not helping the story. Cut it. Get out. And, you know, for the next year, I tried everything. But that stuff makes you grateful. And so when you start, and the other thing is too, David, when you start with opportunities, I've been so bloody lucky getting all of these chances to work with all these remarkable people here. That I've worked for every artistic director except for Tony Guthrie, who was dead before I started acting. You know, everybody's had something to say and something useful and helpful. My career as a classical actor on that thrust stage taught me about cameras. So then I bought a bunch of cameras and asked cameramen, how do you do this? How does it work? It's framing, it's storytelling. I do this on the stage. And now I have a foundation in that. And all I need now is to learn the technical thing of how the camera works. Because the acting truth is going to be the acting truth, whether it's a 2,000 seat auditorium or a 200 millimeter lens. But you got to know the difference between the two.
Yeah.
And so suddenly it occurred to me that it was my obligation to give back. And as I got luckier and luckier in my glorious career working with Clint Eastwood, Michael Mann, Sidney Lumet, John Yoo, Bruce Beresford, Kenny Brown, I mean, the list goes on, Francois Girard. You go, dude, you've been very lucky. If anybody asks you a question, answer them. And so that's what I do. I mean, I'm not a teacher. I'm not a mentor or anything, but I share at the drop of the tiniest hat, any experience. Oh, well, Clint did it like this and Sid liked to do that. And the cameras do this. And my experience, Kenny Branagh said to me when I was trying, I turned to Tony Hopkins and I said, you know, it's not a bad way to start a story.
No, it's not.
And so, you know, I felt it was a responsibility to share information that might help other people along, but then also to provide my services. As I said, to provide those services at very cost effectively to young artists wanting to tell stories. And if I can, if my voice, my name, anything about me participating in it will help them either get financing or just, you know, just get a pretty decent actor in for no money. You know, I've worked hard at this for a long time. I'm not bad at it. I mean, I'm obviously particular and a bit unique. If you need old, bald, white guy and probably evil, I'm in. I'm your man. I'll be there. I'll bring my own lunch or I'll cook for the crew, whatever needs doing. But, you know, there's some use to this. And I find as long as I can be useful, it's remarkably gratifying.
Well, my friend, you are more than useful. And just thank you for the sharing. And I mean, thank you for the work you're doing with Real Canada and obviously the work you do on stage. Just, it's helping our business evolve in so many beautiful ways. I'm all for it, man. Seriously. But just happy Canada Film Day to you. And just again, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
I'm really grateful to you for taking interest, Dave. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Take it easy.
And don't forget to visit our friends over at Bay Street Video for all your DVD, Blu-ray rental or purchasing needs this summer, as they are still open for curbside and some mailing delivery as well. Over at 1172 Bay Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, you can give them a call at 416-964-9088. That's 416-964-9088. Or send them an email at baystreetvideoto@gmail.com for any of your DVD and Blu-ray needs.